The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Listen to this. In my late 30s, a text message arrived to say my husband has been cheating on me and the panic attacks start again. This time, the panic feels like it might kill me. Those are not my words, but they are the words of my next guest, Christine Leach, who found out by text in 2014 that her husband was having an affair, shattering her world. We all know Christine as Ireland's best known arts critic, and she's just published a book. It's a book like no other, I can assure you, about many, many things: art, life, love, marriage, everything. And it's the impact of the moment of this book that I wanted to bring you into. Christine, you're very, very welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Derville. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. I read this in one sitting earlier this week, and it's extraordinary. Book that weaves together, Negative Space is the name, that weaves together your life as a writer, as a critic, as a reviewer. But central to this book is this fundamental moment of your life that many people would struggle to discuss openly.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to discuss, first of all. And I suppose also there's another thing, which is in every story, there's what happens, which is kind of like plot, I suppose, if you're writing fiction. And this is a memoir. So there's what happens. But then there's also what the story's really about, you know. So certainly my marriage ending is a thread that runs through the book. But it's also a book about art and writing and how those things ground me, especially at times when times of great stress, I think. And the book, it started out as a collection of 8 essays, and then it developed, the shape that it took really was a memoir, and that's what it is. It can still be read as 8 essays. It's 8 chapters, and as you read it in one go, it's very short. Like, it's not a very long book. You know, I was joking the other week that it's kind of a Dublin-Cork train journey long. You know, you could read it on the train. So it's a book you can read in one sitting.
And you can read separately, like, almost each chapter, but exactly. I suppose it's the way you weave it, and it's not the way you weave all of these incidents in your life are not linear, you know.
No.
you're being brought forward and you're being pulled back. Let's go back to the very, very start.
Okay.
Because writing has been in your veins since you were a child.
Yeah, and the first chapter in the book is called Writing, and it talks about how that was always a very fundamental part of my own definition of myself, my ability to write. And I think it probably goes back to the fact that I learned to read when I was very young. So I could read when I was 3 years old, and it was before I started school. And I do remember, and I moved schools quite a bit because we moved around with my dad's job, but I do remember primary school teachers and me starting. So I actually went to 3 schools by the time I was in senior infants. So I had a couple of teachers who weren't expecting me to be able to read when I arrived. And I remember being called up to the front of the class, and I think my mum had said to them, well, she can read already, you know. But what she meant was I could read anything. It wasn't that I could just read the reader. So I remember being called up to the front of the class and being asked to read the reader and reading the whole way to the end, and the teacher being like, oh, you can read. So I was reading quite big books from quite a young age. And then
you encountered what every writer and journalist has to get used to, which is rejection quite early on.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, so there's 2 anecdotes in the book, and as you said, it's not linear, so it goes back and forth throughout my experience of writing and all sorts of other things. But yeah, when I was 8 years old, I had won a competition to review books for the RTE Guide, and that was really like my first byline, I guess. Yeah. You know, which is funny.
Do you still have that byline?
I still have the RTE Guides. Yeah. So the competition, and it was open to children throughout Ireland, you know, so it wasn't only me. There were a number of kids in different categories, and I remember the book review I sent in was James and the Giant Peach, the Roald Dahl book. That's what I had reviewed for my entry. But I won the competition, and then I had a kind of a gig reviewing books, which were sent to me by Mary Finn, who was editing the kids' book section.
Dream job.
Yeah, and it was. And it's funny because then I kind of forgot about that for a while. And I also, there's another anecdote in the book about winning a competition for writing a short story. Now, that competition,
like,
the prize was
space.
to get your story published. But I got this letter afterwards saying, well, you won the competition, but we didn't think your story was strong enough to publish it.
Harsh.
Yeah, and for a kid who loves books, you know, and anybody who knows a child who loves to read, you know, books are magic, you know, you love books, you know. And I, That was definitely something that was like a blow to me.
But your mum, who is clearly a huge influence in your life, helped you reframe that rejection in the way that mammies do.
Mammies only do, yeah. So my mum is definitely a huge influence in my life. She's an artist. She, you know, helped me. Well, she told me, you know, that it was good enough, but it just wasn't the right shape. You know, that wasn't that my story wasn't a good story. It was just that it didn't fit, you know, into what they needed to publish it. And I think that's part of how I kind of navigate those rejections as a child. And I really forgot about journalism or anything like that for quite a while. And I didn't come back to it till I was in college. I joined the radio station when I was in UCC. And so broadcasting was my first kind of re-entry back into journalism.
But writing is intrinsic, not just to your professional life, but your life experiences. And there's kind of, you detect sometimes maybe a sense of panic if you're not getting the words right. Is it because you so strongly identified? I know you spoke about a sort of a misheard initially Seamus Heaney quote on the life of a writer.
Yeah, I had listened to this radio documentary which was on RTE, and Seamus Heaney was talking about writing and how the students he'd been teaching at Harvard, he felt that the ones that continued to refer to themselves or considered themselves as writers after they had done that work were the ones who defined themselves by how they wrote, you know. And I think that was very much something that was true for me. And I know now, looking back at my life, that I have been writing constantly. Like, I wrote diaries as a kid, but when in times of huge stress, even when I wasn't publishing words, I was writing myself notes. So this book...
You say writing has caused me panic, it has anchored me, words have saved me and confounded me.
Yeah, because it's also difficult, you know. I mean, and I write about art and people say, God, you know, writing about art is hard, you know, because you're trying to put words on pictures. You're putting words on something that is wordless, you know.
And you're a prolific note taker, which has served you well in this book. I couldn't believe the amount of notes you take when you go to see an exhibition or, you know, a piece of visual art. You must have so much volumes of notes.
Oh, I have so many notebooks in my house still. Like, I kept all the notebooks. What I do is I transcribe them into the laptop, so they're on the laptop too. But when I'm in an exhibition, I walk around and I do this. I must go into what people now talk about as a flow state. I never referred to it as that before, but
kind of a free writing,
totally in the zone. It's a type of stream of consciousness and I'm paying total attention to the work in front of me. So in fact, one of the artworks that's described in the book briefly is Cecily Brennan's film in which there's a woman crying, and that is an 8 minute long film, but I remember I spent an hour in the gallery watching that. And the entire 2-page spread, which was a feature I wrote, it was just one film installation, was based on the notes that I keep writing until I know I have the story or I know that I have what I need to say.
And it's amazing because essentially what you do with the book, obviously the foundational event is the breakdown of your marriage and that text. And we keep coming back to that text and the impact of it. And you are going about your job, you're reviewing all of those things, but you're starting to see your life experience echoed, or you're interpreting from the art that you see that there's a resonance between what you're doing in your working life, reflecting what was happening in your personal life.
This is also part of the conundrum I was trying to unravel in writing this book, because as a journalist, you have this public profile, which is the words you write for publication. And you refer to the notes I take in the gallery. And I do talk in the book about how the notes I take in the gallery are different to what's published because they're more personal. I'm having my very immediate response to the work, you know. And I think, it's the book is almost an attempt to marry the public private selves in a way. It's fragmentary in that it contains lots of types of writing. So there are some pieces from my notebooks. There's pieces that are from published works. There's pieces of fiction in there. Yeah. There's all sorts of things, all different types of writing. And I think for me, writing has always been a way to try and understand myself as well as the world. When I was dealing with the breakdown of my marriage, and I was encountering, in particular, there are some shows that I went to see that were about love, you know, shows about relationships, you know.
Harsh gig after that.
And it's funny because, you know, when you're a journalist, you turn up and do the job, right? You have to turn up and do the job, and the personal stuff isn't important because you're doing the job. But when you're writing about art, and when you're reviewing, and even if it was about music or, you know, or film, or in order to write a really good response to something creative, you do have to have a personal response to it, you know. And I think that was part of the line I was walking. And another thing I was trying to unravel for myself in writing this book was this division that I had kind of established between feeling and thinking. So what you feel when you encounter an artwork and then what you think about it, which is your logical, analytical part, you know.
There was a real contradiction in reading the book, because this text, and we never know who the texter is, and I know you're not going to tell me who it is.
No.
But this text...
or what's in it.
Yeah. Or who sent it, or their motivation. I was so intrigued by it. But this text comes in, it absolutely turns your world upside down. You take to the bed, you're immobilized by it. You describe in visceral, very physical terms, the breakdown of your marriage, and yet there is an enormous respect, if I can say what I took, for the privacy of your husband and maybe the more private matters. Was that difficult to navigate, and how does that relate to the title of this book, which is Negative Space?
Yeah. I mean, the title of the book resonates on a few different levels, and it comes and it's described in the book as, you know, that idea of drawing the negative space. So when my mum is teaching me to draw when I'm quite small, I'm drawing the outline of something as opposed to the actual thing. And then there's a reference to how you might be able to define or articulate something by talking about what's around it instead of what it actually is. Certainly, like as you said at the beginning, talking about marital breakdown is not easy, and we don't do it in Ireland.
No.
We really don't, you know. And talking about the pain of that is not easy, and it's something that's hidden. And I think...
And the physical way you describe that from... Look, I think, was it the... And I'm even doing the action now, but the hand-wringing that you developed, and just the... Even you were saying at a heart level, the physical level, and then those things that happened. Like, I mean, you said suddenly you acquire kind of the big sunglasses, and it's not about style.
No, because you still have to turn up, especially if you're a mum. You have to turn up at the school gate. You have to do the school runs. You have to make the lunches. All the while maybe your world and the shape of your world is falling apart. And I do think as well, marriages don't suddenly end. They take time to unravel, you know. So there's a period of time where maybe you're trying to fix it. Maybe you're trying to work it out, you know.
Yeah, there was that chapter. Sorry, I keep jumping forward because I kept remembering this, the ringing in my ear. You developed tinnitus about a year before the text came through. For you, was that that and you describe very kind of intricately trying to navigate that that sensation, the sounds, everything. Do you think that was some sort of a trigger warning from your body, or something that was coming to tell you that, I suppose, of a foreshock of things that were to come?
Yeah, it's quite easy in the aftermath of something to look back and kind of put another narrative on it and say, oh, this is what this meant. But a lot of the book is about anxiety and how it manifests in the body. And I do think that my own anxiety, anyway, often comes from the gap between what things look like and what they feel like. And that was something that I was trying to really write about, as I said, like in an embodied way, what it felt like, but also to try and put some sort of logical understanding on it, you know. So it's a sort of a dance between feeling it and trying to articulate it. There was ringing in my ears, and anybody who's had tinnitus or tinnitus, you know, will know it's terrible. It won't go away. It keeps you awake. It's the first thing you hear when you wake up.
It sends you crazy.
It's really, and it makes you feel like you're going mad because no one else can hear it. And there's a buzzing in your ears, right? So and it distracts you from everything. So it's really hard to function when that's going on. And I do talk about it in the book, you know, the different doctors I went to deal with that. And I will say now, it's not there anymore, but it comes back at times of great stress. So I think the body remembers, you know. So I find now, if anything happens that might be a sudden shock, I get a sharp ringing in my ears, and I've learnt jaw exercises to relax my jaw, which is the main thing that has worked for me. So I also have trained as a yoga teacher, so there's a lot of breathing and relaxing. I found for me, and it won't work for everybody, that if I really relax my jaw, the ringing goes away again, and then it's gone. But I do think the body feels things that the mind doesn't know, and I talk about that in the book as a kind of a warning signal. But again, this book is an attempt to understand and maybe unravel and work my way through some really painful and difficult things. And it's through the lens of my own experience. And I tried to make it as embodied as I could.
But
really.
It's the lens of your own experience. I think part of the reason why I was, as you can see, my own copy is lots of lines through it.
Oh,
my goodness. Yes, because you do articulate, I suppose, what happens when people go through a major trauma, a major grief, that people will identify with it. But I one of the kind of things I thought was ironic that... at the same time as you are really viscerally expressing this impact, at the same time minding the players, including presumably your former partner and children, you also became obsessed with affairs.
Yeah. I got really interested in this idea of like where, you know, and again, that's the negative space. It's like the unseen thing, you know, the unseen, the secret place where people might go, you know.
And how did that manifest, or how did that sort of bear itself out?
Well, it's like, you know, if you've been in a relationship for a long time and then it's over, you're suddenly free to go places and do things that maybe you wouldn't have done before, you know. So, yeah, I went on dates, you know, and I met people. And, you know, I got really interested in this idea of not telling people where I was all the time, you know, because when you're married, somebody always knows where you are, especially. And if you're a mom, somebody always knows where you are. And after you separate, if you're co-parenting and the children are moving between the two parents, as a mother, you suddenly have some time where you don't have to be physically present in the home. Nobody needs you right now. And maybe
and they
you
don't need
go,
to know where you are.
They don't necessarily need to know where you are. You can be contactable, obviously. So I think that was part of me working through all of these feelings. And, you know, I think when something traumatic happens, we do different things, some of which are useful and helpful and some of which are possibly more damaging to ourselves, like unhealthy things that we do to try and cope with difficult things. And yeah, some of that was that. And I also felt an urge to run away a lot. So I kept getting in the car to leave, you know, to go places, just to friends, to somewhere else. And again, having to leave the house to go and look at art, and that being my job, and art being my safe place. Like, I feel at home in galleries. I feel at home when I am standing in front of a painting and just interrogating it with my eyes, you know.
And one form of the visual arts that you explore a lot in the book is audio and sound. And you there's a way in which you describe, and unfortunately your husband and you couldn't find a solution. It did end in a dissolution of the marriage. But you say at one stage that you and your husband were on different frequencies, and instead of amplifying each other, you cancel each other out. And again, I thought that was a very, very interesting description. And was that, and a lot of it, because what happens is you describe something personal and then you go into some esoteric review and then you bring it back and you're just going, where is this all going? But it's...
That actually probably came from another thing that I describe in the book, which was I was at the Electric Picnic and I had this gong bath, which is where, you know, so you're lying down and these gongs are placed around you, big gongs, and they're banged with a gong stick, whatever that is. And these sound waves go over your body. So it's like a sound bath. And there's the description in the book of that happening and me feeling like I was everywhere and nowhere at once. You know, there were all the words and no words. It was like a total silence. And it made me realise that, you know, sound waves can amplify into like something enormous, almost overwhelming, like a wave, you know, that could just obliterate you. But also it's an amazing place to kind of find yourself. So I think that description of the two of us maybe not being on the same frequency or being on frequencies that didn't, you know, great relationships, I suppose, the people amplify each other. I mean, that's, you know, there's loads of double layers and meanings in the
language
in the book.
There's so many layers
of meaning.
One of our listeners says, we're talking about text, she says, how the message is delivered is so important. I learned about my husband's infidelity by way of a speeding ticket. It took 10 years to get a divorce. I'm still dealing with the fallout and there's a never-ending anxiety and trauma. One thing that you do speak to that will be very familiar, I suppose, to both men and women navigating our judicial separation and divorce procedures is just that whole sense of, particularly for women, the lack of female of autonomy, maybe in terms of finance or other things, that was something else that you had to navigate a whole new world.
Yeah, and I think a lot of my anxiety came from a huge fear about the future, and it was financial fear, you know, because a marriage and two people together bringing up
a
family, that's one thing, right? And you work out a way for that to work financially for all of you in that marriage, in that family. It's a family, you know, you work out a way for the family to work. And then if you break that, then how is it going to work? You know, you can't live in the same house anymore. You may need to support two households. How is it going to work? How do you support the childcare? How do you do it? And I suppose most people listening will probably know the job of an art critic is not a full-time job. I've been freelancing in that role for many years, nearly 20 years with the Sunday Times. And so it's not something that you can use to pay all the bills as such, right? But it was also a really amazing thing to be doing while my kids were young because it worked with that. I could write at night. I could write while they were asleep. When they were small, I took them in buggies to the exhibitions, you know. And Dorothy Walker's actually talked about, she's an art critic who worked for the Sunday Times before. She talked about how you could do that with children. Like, she would do art criticism on the radio because it worked with having a small family. So when you break the family and it doesn't work like that
anymore.
And
you had this ideal home that
you
built.
Yeah, we built a house together and we did all those things, you know. And of course, like, there's also that part of the book, which is that you don't ever expect to be undoing this. Like, you don't marry somebody expecting that not to last. And it's true for both parties, you know.
Of course.
And the financial worries are true for both parties too. Like, how will us as individuals move forward?
And something's very, very strong in the book, both on, I suppose, on a very practical but also very emotional level, is that concept of home. Like, you talked about how you moved a lot when you were younger, but was that challenge for you, that whole sense of home and who you were after, you know, the text that changed everything?
You know, I think the home is like a container for the family, you know. And so if the family is no longer going to be the shape that it has been, then the home has to change shape too, you know. And I know often people decide one party or the other will stay in the family home. In our case, we decided to sell the family home, and we have two separate homes now. And that's really hard too for people, because that's where people feel anchored. Home is where you feel anchored. So even if the marriage is breaking, you know, everybody in that family may feel like they want to stay put in that home because that's their home, you know.
And there is, you know, home in terms of a physical space, but you also explore in the book how you went in search of home in terms of your own kind of place in the world. Like, you went kind of off kind of on the trail of your ancestors.
Yeah, I had actually written a thesis about my great-great aunt Eileen McAdam when I did my master's in journalism, and I went back to look at that. So I, on my mum's side, that family, Pa McAdam was the name of the patriarch there, and he established the North of Ireland Publishing Company, and he ran the Donegal Vindicator, Derry Weekly News, a lot of other newspapers. There was a group of newspapers, and he handed over editorship of the Donegal Vindicator to his daughter Eileen when she was just in her early 20s, and it was at the time of the Civil War. So there's this very interesting history of journalism in my family, which I only really investigated in my 20s and then kind of went away from again, and I've come back to it in this book. But also there's a quote from her in the book around, you know, women and writing and the dangers of women who like to write. And a lot of what's in this book is also about finding a voice to articulate things that we're not meant to talk about.
It's a very, very brave book, and I was just kind of thinking, I know you became sort of obsessed with celebrities and kind of there at first, but I'm presuming there isn't going to be a Agatha Christie style pursuit of who sent that text. I'm so curious, and so will anybody be who reads this book. But are you grateful in any sense to the person who sent the text?
Absolutely. You know, and in a way it doesn't matter what was in the text, because that's just a trigger for what happened next, you know. I'm hugely grateful for so many things now. At the time, and time has passed, you know, like, I couldn't have written this book 4 years ago, I couldn't have written it 2 years ago, okay? So time has passed. Obviously there was anger, sadness, rage, bitterness, shame, all of those feelings, and they were huge. But as time passes and everybody moves on, you know, they dissipate.
Has it been cathartic for you?
Writing the book, in a way, I don't really like that word cathartic, because people talk about art being cathartic too, you know. I think it's about articulating experience and being able to put some things down. It's like, I've put them down in the book and I can put them down here and I've given them shape, you know. And there's something very satisfying about being able to give a shape to something and put it down, because then you can move on. But definitely gratitude. Like, I'm grateful for how big my world got. There are more people in my world now. Collaboration became a bigger part of my professional work. I discovered all sorts of skill sets I didn't know I had, because I had to go out and get other paid work as well. You know, I was working as a technical writing trainer. I went back into corporate communications. I did all sorts of things and discovered that the skills of an art critic are transferable into these unexpected places, you know.
It is remarkable. Christine, from the personal to the universal, it is memoir, but it's so many other things beside, and all that remains, I suppose, say congratulations. If you want to come back and let us know who sent the text, you can, of course, but until then, it is just an extraordinary memoir, Negative Space by Christine Lynch, and it's published by the Merriam Press. So thank you for coming in to chat to us today. We're going to take a very quick break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.